Hello there. Today is Friday, September 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, impeachment seems all but inevitable for President of the United States.
The president thinks that this proves his innocence only goes to show how further he doesn't understand right from wrong.
Cameroon continues its resolve not to accept foreign mediators to help solve its separatist crisis. Also ahead, the official headline musical act for the National Football League's Super Bowl halftime show has been announced. It's all on today's International Edition. Democrats in the U.S. House of Representatives promised swift action Wednesday on the now formalized impeachment inquiry into U.S. President Donald Trump. But congressional Republicans argued the White House release of a memo of Trump's phone call with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky only revealed the political motivations of the investigations. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more on the next steps in the impeachment inquiry on Capitol Hill.
New questions for President Trump as the American public gets the first look at the whistleblower complaint outlining a number of concerns about Trump's call with Zelensky, including allegations White House officials covered up the details.
The complaint states that the White House tried to lock down all records of the call, especially the word-for-word transcript. That gave the whistleblower reason to believe that they, the White House, understood the gravity of what transpired in that call.
House Democrats had threatened to take the nation's top intelligence official to court to obtain the complaint.
By law, the whistleblower complaint, which brought this gross misconduct to light, should have been presented to this committee weeks ago, and by you, Mr. Director, under the clear letter of the law. And yet it wasn't.
McGuire said he had respected the legal rights of the presidency in an unprecedented situation.
We're advised that much of the information in the complaint was, in fact, subject to executive privilege, a privilege that I do not have the authority to waive.
McGuire acknowledged the whistleblower was credible and right to come forward, but refused to address concerns Trump meddled with the process.
Did you ever speak to the president about this complaint?
My conversations with the president, because I'm the director of national intelligence, are privileged, and it would be inappropriate for me because it would destroy my relationship with the president in intelligence matters to divulge any of my conversations with the president of the United States.
Trump dismissed the complaint as a political gambit.
The Democrats are going to lose the election. They know it. That's why they're doing it.
A view supported by congressional Republicans.
What in this case rises to impeachment? This is a president of the United States that had a conversation with a leader in another country. Never before has a president had to put forth their conversation. The reason why he had to put forth his conversation.
But the complaint was enough to push House Democrats into a formal impeachment inquiry.
This whistleblower has given us a roadmap for our investigation.
Investigations that could end with a vote on the House floor on articles of impeachment.
There are some in our caucus who think, let's just have an impeachment. No, we have to have an inquiry to further establish the facts. There is no rush to judgment, and in some ways, we are a jury.
Many House Democrats saying they want to see that vote by the end of this year, before the 2020 presidential election gets fully underway next February. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Capitol Hill.
And despite the developments, President Trump remained defiant on Thursday.
It's a terrible thing for our country. They can't do any work. They're frozen. The Democrats are going to lose the election. They know it. That's why they're doing it.
Well, for further analysis on the legal and constitutional part of all of this, we are joined by Robert Deitz, professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University's Schar School of Public Policy and Government. So how big of a problem constitutionally are these allegations?
Absolutely. This is serious. You know, all democracies rest upon a belief that the electoral system is fair. And, you know, I think virtually every country in the world these days holds elections, but very few of them actually hold fair elections. And so a sense that a foreign country, at the request of our president, being asked to uncover information so as to undermine the chances of the election of his opponent, undermines this principal notion of fair elections. So absolutely, this is a serious issue and serious constitutional issue. Yes, high crimes and misdemeanors, if you had to pick one core thing that would fall into that, it's anything that undermines the integrity of our electoral system.
Is high crimes and misdemeanors a part of our Constitution?
Yes. It's in the impeachment provision. The term actually comes out of ancient English law, and the term misdemeanors in that context doesn't mean what we think of it today. Misdemeanor is kind of a minor crime, doesn't quite get up to the felony level.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the way it's used in the impeachment provision. As I say, it comes out of old English law, and it means something really, really serious. High crimes.
What about the Democrats' claim as part of their action on an impeachment inquiry that the president's actions are a national security issue? Given that you have national security expertise, would you say that that's correct, that this was a national security?
I'm not sure I quite understand that. Certainly it's a national security issue in the sense that our national security depends upon free and fair elections. So that, to that extent, yes, I think that's an accurate statement. If one tries to infer that somehow our safety, meaning from military attack and that sort of national security, I don't really see that. But certainly, again, from the integrity of our electoral system, yes, this is a threat to our security, meaning maintaining honest elections.
What about if the president were to be found to have specifically withheld congressionally approved financial support to Ukraine to fight against Russia's aggression toward that country? Would that be considered a national security risk?
Yeah, Article 2, Section 4, I think it is, obligates the president effectively to uphold the law. And so when Congress awarded this money, it intended that it be spent. And for the president to withhold it and kind of add another qualification, as it were, another condition, certainly violates the law.
What about others within the president's administration, such as the vice president, the attorney general, the secretary of state, anyone else who may have been involved in whether it's blocking the whistleblower complaint or pressuring the president of Ukraine in some way? Are any of these people at risk or have some liability here to be potentially impeached or in trouble as well?
Yes, I could make up a set of facts where there might be some potential criminal liability, but I think realistically, no. Rudy Giuliani is kind of a wild card. He seems to sort of work as Trump's fixer, even though he holds no official position.
All right. That is Robert Dietz, professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University's Schar School of Public Policy and Government. Thanks for being with us. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The White House aims for a historic low in refugee settlement. The U.S. is sending troops and weaponry to the Saudis to boost the kingdom's air defenses. China's foreign minister says Beijing is willing to buy more U.S. products. And the number of vaping-related lung illnesses is on the rise. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The National Transportation Safety Board is issuing several recommendations as part of the investigations into two deadly crashes of Boeing 737 MAX jets. The AP's Ed Donahue reports.
One recommendation is that Boeing should consider how confusion in the cockpit can slow down response by pilots when there is some kind of problem. The suggestion is Boeing underestimates response time to diagnose and react because of multiple alarms going off, competing for attention. Max planes crashed in Indonesia and Ethiopia in the past year, killing 348 people. It will be up to investigators there to determine what caused the accidents. Preliminary reports point to an anti-stall system that kicked in based on faulty sensor readings, pushing the noses of the planes down. Ed Donahue, Washington.
Cameroon has reiterated it will not accept any foreign mediator in the dialogue it called to solve the separatist crisis that's claimed at least 2,000 lives in the Central African state, saying that some foreign governments that have opted to mediate may be in doing it in bad faith. Invited separatist leaders based in the United States and European countries have indicated that they will not be party to the dialogue if it's not held outside of Cameroon with non-Cameroonians as mediators. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports.
The week-long dialogue on the separatist crisis is due to begin Monday in Yaoundé. The government says it has invited more than 1,000 people, including lawmakers, clergy, teachers and civil society activists. However, none of the US and Europe-based separatist leaders contacted by VOA said they will attend the talks. Among those turning down the invitation is Eric Tato, who lives in the United States. He says he will not attend because he and fellow separatists based in the diaspora are wanted in Cameroon on charges of secession and terrorism. Those are the same charges for which separatist leaders Ayuk Tabe Julius and 10 collaborators were arrested and sentenced to life in prison by a Yaoundé military tribunal. Tato says Cameroon should free Julius and the other leaders as a sign they are truly ready for dialogue.
I have told them categorically clear, let them release all detainees and then start discussing with them, and then from there we'll know if the president of Cameroon is serious to have dialogue or not.
Fighting in northwest and southwest Cameroon has claimed more than 2,000 lives since hostilities broke out 2 years ago. English-speaking armed groups in those regions want to break away from the rest of Cameroon and its French-speaking majority. Some separatists have said on social media they want the dialogue to take place either in Switzerland or Ivory Coast under the supervision of world powers like the US, Germany and Britain, and in the presence of the United Nations. George Ewani, spokesperson of the National Dialogue, says Cameroon's President Paul Biya has ruled out the possibility of inviting a foreign mediator. Some nations that have offered to mediate, he says, have not stopped Cameroonians in the diaspora from financially sponsoring violence back home.
Some make the propositions in good faith, but we also know that others don't do that exactly in good faith. Now, let me ask a question. Are Cameroonians really unable to solve their own problems to the extent of seeking a foreign mediation? The answer is an emphatic no. International mediation is not necessary.
Ewane did not name the countries he was referring to, but last July, the Swiss ambassador to Cameroon, Pietro Lazzeri, announced his country was helping the Cameroon's government negotiate with the rebels. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Former French president and political survivor Jacques Chirac died Wednesday at the age of 86. Chirac, who weathered uneasy coalition governments as well as corruption charges, was also known as Chirac the African for his fondness for the country or continent. He was the man behind the Kwai Branly Museum dedicated to the art from Africa and other regions, and was also known for allegedly continuing longstanding and opaque ties between France and its former colonies known as Françafrique. Anita Bryant reports from Paris.
Jacques Chirac was the ultimate political survivor, mayor of Paris for 18 years before becoming prime minister and later president for more than a decade.
Ces heures noires souillent à jamais notre histoire et sont une injure
He will be remembered for many things, including being the first French head of state to acknowledge his country's role in the Holocaust in a 1995 speech, for also opposing the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in 2003, leading to retaliatory freedom fries served at U.S. restaurants and the dumping of Bordeaux wine into gutters, even as anti-war protesters cheered him on.
Un accueil comme Jacques Chirac les aime. Dans les rues de Ouagadougou, ils sont des milliers pour
chanter. He will also be remembered for being a staunch fan of Africa. Chirac was close friends with several African leaders, including Omar Bongo of Gabon, Blaise Compaoré of Burkina Faso, and the Republic of Congo's Denis Sassou Nguesso. He founded the Quai Branly Museum that showcases art from Africa, along with Oceania and the Americas. In 2016, it was renamed the Quai Branly Jacques Chirac Museum. Critics, however, claim such ties also underscored the downsides of France's continued influence on its former colonies, known as France-Afrique.
Ce soir, nous célébrons la République.
At home, Chirac had a mixed record. In a shock election in 2002, he found himself in a runoff against far-right leader Jean-Marie Le Pen, winning easily in what many called a vote against extremism. But he failed to overhaul the economy or sustainably address tensions of disenfranchised youngsters with immigrant backgrounds in France's gritty suburbs, which exploded in 2005. But his popularity rebounded after leaving power in 2007, even as some of the corruption allegations dogging him for years finally caught up with him in court. Still, many remember Chirac for his charm and his common touch, a man at ease with both diplomats and farmers. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. voanews.com.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. A powerful new documentary called Anthropocene, the Human Epic, which premiered in New York this week to coincide with the UN Climate Summit and Climate Week, is a vivid depiction of humanity's massive re-engineering of the planet. The film, which took 4 years to make, combines art, film, virtual reality, and scientific research to investigate human influence on the state, dynamic, and future of the Earth. And joining us now to talk more about it is one of the world-renowned directors and collaborators on the film, Jennifer Butwal. Thank you for being with us. How did this research, which was originally in a book form, turn into a film?
We were inspired by the research of the Anthropocene Working Group scientists who, for 13 years, have been investigating human influence on the systems of the Earth. And we use their research as our starting point for this film. And they have all kinds of categories of research, like terraforming of the Earth for agriculture, industrialization, mining, etc. Anthroturbation, which is human tunneling under the Earth for subways and sewers and mines, etc. Extinction, climate change. And these were their categories. And we put them, we looked at each of those, and we spent a year with them in a, on a big board in our research room, adding images to them, trying to find places all over the world that were the most powerful, salient examples of human influence in those categories.
Is it something that people can understand very directly when they watch this film? And what do you expect that they would take away from it?
Let's step back and think in geological time. The Earth is 4.5 billion years old, and modern human civilization has really only been about 10,000 years. And yet, we as a species now have, what the scientists say, tipped the planet outside its natural limits. So I think it's very important for people to understand the extent of our influence. And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying in this film, as the scientists are trying to do, to alert our species to the extent of our influence on the Earth. And I think that that is an important thing because I think a lot of people don't know that yet.
Give us a couple of examples.
Climate change is the obvious example. When we think about the carbon that we put into the atmosphere through fossil fuel use, etc., humans are definitely the biggest influencer of climate change. And what's interesting is that in the past, we've been stuck in these debates about whether or not it is true. And of course, there's something very strategic about being stuck in a debate where you're talking about whether it exists or not, because it keeps you from moving forward with solutions. That's one thing. The other thing is extinction. We're in the middle of the sixth great extinction, largely caused by human activity. Not just hunting, poaching, fishing, but mostly habitat loss and pollution. These are things that we are doing when we urbanize, when we take away wild space, when we create bigger mines, in industry, etc. Agriculture, huge. Agriculture is the biggest terraformer of the planet. What we need to grow food, the land we need to grow food. So many species are being eradicated because of our impact. A lot of these things are reversible if we change our behavior. But for us, this film is not a polemic. It's not a didactic film. It's not telling you what to do. It's taking you to the places you're responsible for but would never normally see, so that you can experience them for yourselves and go, wow, that's what that looks like. Hmm. That's what the biggest open pit coal mine in Germany looks like, and the biggest human-made machine on the planet called the Bagger, which is a bucket wheel excavator. And these are all the towns that have been destroyed to make way for the expansion of the mine. We're all energy users, so that mine is a symbol for all of our energy.
Just by the very nature of the film, without having to tell people what to do or not to do, just showing them in very stark terms what is happening and what we are doing would seem like it would be another powerful way for the most intelligent species on the planet to grasp the gravity of what it has done to alter things.
And also, remember, people turn away from bad news. Our films are meditative, they're art films, basically, and you're kind of immersed in these worlds. And some of them are like, it's always this question of, oh my God, how can something so terrible be so beautiful? But if it's not a aesthetically compelling, you're not going to pay attention to it. So when you're there and you stay in this place for a little while and then starts to sink in that, oh, I'm in Norilsk. I'm in a town in Siberia that has the largest colored metal mine on the planet, and the palladium in my cell phone comes from this place. And it's one of the most polluted places on Earth. Mm. And here are three women who work in the smelter whose life expectancy will be diminished because of their work, and they are related to the cell phone that I'm talking to you on right now to do this interview. That kind of implication, recognition of implication, is our goal, but not to squash you, to make you think, wow, understanding leads to transformation, and transformation leads to a change of behavior. Deep experiential understanding.
Why should people see this film? And when they walk away from it, will they feel hopeful, hopeless, or just more aware?
I will say that this whole project is carbon offset, which is very important, because when I think about the energy use that we used to make this film and all the places that we went to, it better have some kind of an impact, or it would have been better if we just stayed home and went to bed, you know? So I hope it has an impact. But here's what I think. Everywhere we went, and I'm talking about some of the most desolate places on Earth, there was something that made me hopeful. In Norilsk, the women who are living with dignity, surviving, making a living, supporting their family. At the London Zoo, the woman who has spent spent 2 years raising mountain chicken frog babies to be released back into the wild because they are almost extinct in the wild. Those things are uplifting, right? The people mm-hmm. in Dandora landfill living their lives with dignity in one of the most extreme places on earth. So I feel like, for me, the time for lamenting and the time for debate about whether what we're doing is really what we're doing is over. And it's the time to become change agents of the Anthropocene. It's the time to move forward. And being here right now in New York with the Climate Assembly, with the assembly going on and Climate Week, and seeing all the people who were out here last week on the Climate March all over the world, my daughter marching, us marching, I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that we're reaching a saturation point of understanding. In the two elections that are coming up, yours and ours in Canada, there are a lot of people who are saying that climate change is their most important issue. It's their biggest issue. That's never happened before. You've got to feel hopeful about that.
All right. Well, that is world-renowned director of the new documentary Anthropocene, The Human Epic, Jennifer Bajwal. Thank you for being with us. Jennifer Lopez Thursday announced she and pop star Shakira will be headlining the National Football League's Super Bowl halftime show in Miami in February. The 50-year-old Lopez is currently basking in the success of her much-lauded performance in the recently released film Hustlers. She dropped the news in a tweeted photo of her and Shakira sporting matching metallic gold tube tops and black leather pants and saying with emojis that they are going to set the world on fire. The Latina superstars will be part of the NFL's bid to rebuild its embattled halftime show. One of pop music's most visible gigs, which last year struggled to secure performers over the treatment of former San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick. Kaepernick, who's not played in the NFL since opting out of his contract with the 49ers in March of 2017, began kneeling in protest of social injustice and racial inequality during pre-game renditions of the U.S. national anthem 3 years ago. The move became a talking point for Donald Trump in September of 2017, with the U.S. president saying the players were insulting the nation and should be fired. If you don't believe me, I can show you. Don't go thinking you can use me. You don't care too much, you can lose me. Best believe I'm coming true. And you've been listening to International Edition. That's going to do it today for our show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Keith Holmes. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day. No fighting. Shakira. I never really knew that she could dance like this. She make a man wanna speak Spanish. Como se llama? Bonita. Picasso. Shakira, Shakira. Oh, baby, when you talk like that, you make a woman go mad. So be wise and keep on reading the signs of my body. I'm on tonight, you know my hips don't lie. And I'm starting to feel it's right. All the attraction, the tension. See, baby, this is perfection. Hey, girl, I can see your body moving. And it's driving me crazy. And I didn't have the slightest idea until I saw you dancing. And when you walk up on the dance floor, nobody can add it all. The way you move your body, girl. And everything's so unexpected, the way you right and left it. So you can keep on shaking it. Never really knew that she could dance like this. She make a man want to speak Spanish. Como se llama? Shakira. Oh, baby, when you talk like that, you make a woman go mad. So be wise and keep on reading the signs of my body. I'm on tonight, you know my hips don't lie. And I'm starting to feel your joy. Come on, let's go real slow. Don't you see, baby, I see it's perfect. I know I'm on tonight, my hips don't lie. And I'm starting to feel it's right. All the attraction, the tension. Baby, Shakira, this is perfection. Shakira. Oh boy, I can see your body moving. Half animal, half man. I don't really know what I'm doing, but you seem to have a plan. My will, selfish thing.
So sexy, I am a fantasy, a refugee like me back with the Fugees from a third world country. I go back like when Pac carried crates for Humpty Hump. We lead a whole club, Jizzy. Why the CIA wanna watch it? Colombians and Haitians, I ain't guilty, it's a musical transaction. No more do we snatch rope, refugees run the seas cause we own our own boat.
This is